The vibration of change. That magical place where life shifts from struggle to ease. From stagnation to forward movement. From old ways of being to new ways of becoming. Yes, it can seem rather elusive to get there, but when you are in it, you feel it down to your very core, and it can positively affect everything in your life, from your relationships to your health and well-being, from your career path to your abundance, from the quality of your inner connection to the fullness of your self-expression. Here on the Christine Upchurch Show, we explore ways to get into that vibration of change with experts in the fields of consciousness, psychology, spirituality, health, healing, and science. Are you ready to step into your vibration of change?
Hello, everybody. Welcome. You might be listening live on Facebook Live on my professional page on transformationtalkradio.com. You might be listening live in the Seattle area on 1150 AM KKNW, or after the fact on one of the numerous podcasts it sends up in, or on my YouTube channel. But wherever and whenever you're joining us from today, very grateful to have you here. We're going to be having an interesting conversation, but before I share what that's about and who our guests are, I want to say hello to Jacob at TTR, Transformation Talk Radio. How are you doing today, Jacob?
Doing very well. How are you today, Christine?
Good, thanks. It's October. It's sunny. I have no more complaints.
No kidding. And it's beautiful today out there.
It is. And hello to Mr. Benny Mathers at KKNW.
Hi, Christine. And this is the month you get to dust off your witch hat, I believe.
Yes. And you know me because over the years at KKNW, you know, every once in a while I would show up around the time of the either on Halloween or the time of the Halloween party there. And I have one Halloween costume. And that's it.
So. I love seeing it every year, though. You will have to debut it again.
Okay. Oh, gosh. You know, folks, we recently crossed a milestone, not only here in the United States, but around the world. And that was the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. And if you're like most of us, you know where you were when you found out about it. And there are some who will not only just have it as this distant memory of this painful thing that happened to the collective, they have terrible confusion and pain associated with it being a personal experience. And our guest today is going to be talking about exactly that. Our guest today, his name is Ray McGinnis, and he was born in Vancouver, Canada. He still lives over the border up there, and he holds a BA in Religious Studies from the University of Toronto. He has served as a national staff for Youth and Young Adult Ministries with the United Church of Canada, and he was on the program staff of the Naramata Center in British Columbia. Since 1999, he's been a freelance journalist. And he's also presented workshops in journal writing, poetry, and memoirs. And he has presented to over 15,000 workshop participants. He's taught at business conferences, churches, et cetera, et cetera. And he's the author of Writing the Sacred. And he's got a new book out that's called Unanswered Questions. And that's about what happened on 9/11 and what's happening to the families since then. They're trying to get answers to their questions. I'd like to welcome our guest today, Ray McGinnis. Hi, Ray.
Great to be with you, Christine.
You know, when I hear about your background, I know that, you know, many of us are curious. Many of us really do want answers. I'm kind of curious, though, about why you pursued this more deeply than some of us. What prompted you to take a deep dive into what the questions were and how they're still being unanswered?
Well, I hadn't planned on writing a book at all. I mean, I was in Joshua Tree National Park in southeastern California on September 11th at a retreat setting with 60 other people. I was the only person who was not an American citizen, the others from about 20 different states across your country. And I had just gone for a walk at sunrise. It's hot in September in Joshua Tree. And so I was up before breakfast walking and saw the cactus and everything. And then there was the stretching and meditation session at 7 a.m. And in the middle of that, someone came in and said, "There's, you know, had been on the phone. There was no radio or TV where I was." And they said, "There's been this attack, the towers, Pentagon." And one of the people in the room, two people in the room, had a financial advisor who managed their stock portfolio who worked in one of the Twin Towers. So it was very, you know, degrees of separation right away. And when I came back, I couldn't leave because there were all the flights were grounded. And I was one of the people who couldn't get out of America. Eventually, I took a bus from Seattle up to Blaine and crossed the border after 3 hours of searching with customs. And then, you know, I went on with my life. I mean, everything was going on, the Afghan war, the Iraq war, the 9/11 commission happened. But in Vancouver, at least, It was hardly a blip on the radar screen. It wasn't like Watergate or anything else. It was just not much coverage. And so I just happened to be on another writing workshop book tour with Writing the Sacred in 2007. And I was in an airport looking for a book because I'd finished the one I was on. I had 10 more days before my tour was over in the Canadian prairies. And there was a book in the airport bookstore called Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow by Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband, Ron, died in the South Tower. And sometimes I'm away from the news because I've got a weekend or a week-long writing workshop. But otherwise, I'm checking in with the news mostly by radio, sometimes by newsprint, occasionally by TV. So I think that I follow it closely like many people do. But I was surprised when I picked up her book to find out that not only were there family members who, you know, went to funerals, published obituaries, or read the names of their loved ones on anniversaries, or had features about what a remarkable person this was who died, but there were many families who also went to Washington, D.C. to try and learn the lessons about what had happened and make their nation safe. And I thought that that was an interesting story. And so I just I went to the website that they had, which is still on today, with all their many questions and their nearly 50 press releases. And I just started to create a file of newspaper clippings based on what they were reporting. And that sat there. My dad had cancer, multiple myeloma, in 2010 to 2014. So I was not following my book idea at all. I was just being a caregiver. And then after he died, I was with the the estate, and so all of 2014 was all about trying to not fall apart, telling a teller at a bank or a person about the golf club that his membership was over because he died. So I was not in the space at all to think about a book at all. But by 2015, I've written poems and other things. And someone was asking me, "Are you doing anything else?" And I mentioned this idea that I had, which initially was just personally writing about my own, where I was on September 11th, writing my own personal reflections. And that was just a private thing I'd shared with a few people. But somebody said to me, "Well, I've never heard about any families going to Washington, D.C. or doing anything like that." And I talked to a cousin of mine in the San Francisco Bay Area who watches CNN and MSNBC nearly nightly and prides herself with being up to date all the time. And I talked to her about it, and she said she'd never heard of the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission. And I thought, well, maybe there's a book in this. Maybe there needs to be someone who's maybe. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to write a hard scrabble book about political science or current affairs the way many people do that are very left brain. I will have to deal with some difficult material, but I'm going to write this so that anybody who's taken a writing workshop from me, journaling through grief and loss, poetry and nature walking workshop, or a memoir class, could read my book and make it accessible. And I thought the only way into that is through personal narrative and layering a lot of my book with the voices of the families.
Mm. And first of all, I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I know how difficult it is when we lose a loved one. And when a loved one dies of natural causes or of a disease, or even some sort of random accident, it's incredibly hard to process. But I can't imagine those people who have to somehow contextualize their loved one's death within the context of such a horrific, horrific situation, trying to make some sense out of it. So what is it about the personal stories that motivates you to, you know, put it out there that there are these unanswered questions that need to be answered?
Well, I begin with compassion and sympathy for the story that starts with Patty Cassaz's husband, John, died on September 11th in the North Tower. She, you know, gets involved in having the funeral. And then in the aftermath, after people have come to the service, then she's there alone. And she's a nursing student. She has her son, John Jr., and she's left to look at the empty chair at the meal table each day. And so for her way for dealing with her grief and healing was to just come to peace with it by reading some news articles to try and understand how did this, you know, lapse in defense happen. And as she read more and more articles, she found that things didn't seem to line up from article to article. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's that kind of story of at first the expectation. I know you talk about seeking and finding in some of your writing, and she thought that she would seek and then she would find that all the stories made sense. And if you put a story beside the Washington Post with the New York Times and the Boston Globe and the Seattle Post Intelligencer, they'd all basically make sense and it would be fine. But when you have people making different statements that are contradictory, there was no military response, there was a military response, and so on. So they start to wonder, well, you know, maybe we need to investigate. And so I was interested in that story. And also because for most of us, if we have a loss, even if it's related to some sort of international or political event, I think that the lure is to grieve privately and heal privately. Very few of us are going to say, okay, I've had this awful thing happen in my own personal life with my own personal family members, and I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. or Olympia, Washington or City Hall in Seattle and knock on the doors and try and change things or, you know, get traffic lights in this, you know, even if it's a car accident and people should have always had a stoplight there. People don't always do that. So I was interested in the select fewer number of families that decided that it was important enough to make the nation safe, and which was a bigger vision because they thought that they had something to offer.
When I think back, I mean, of course, I know exactly where I was on the morning of 9/11. And it's such an incredibly shocking thing. And when you look at the destruction, it was complete, total destruction of the Twin Towers and a lot of destruction with the Pentagon. One of the things that's always confused me is that somehow they knew who did it within a very short period of time, which makes me question the narrative. Is that one of the unanswered questions?
Well, that was, you know, Kristen Breitwiser, whose husband Ron died, whose book I read, Wake Up Call, was the person who of the family members who spoke before the joint 9/11 inquiry of the Senate and Congress on the 18th September 2002. And she said, how is it possible for, you know, for the government to, on the one hand, say it didn't have any idea who these people are. And then within hours, like, you know, before noon that morning, they're saying, here are the 19 hijackers. Here's a videotape from a grocery store or a 7-Eleven up in Maine or Portland. All kinds of information is also suddenly available. And she's saying, were we tracking these people? Did we know something before this? How can you have people boarding planes with mace and pepper spray, which are prohibited? All kinds of questions that she had, and the questions that she was asking weren't regarded as ridiculousness. All of the people sitting before her on the Senate and Congress Intelligence Committee said, these are really good questions and we need some answers. And the result of her testimony in September 2002, it created a political firestorm, and people in the White House told the press that a train was coming and nothing would stop it. And so by November of 2002, President Bush signed legislation to have an investigation that for 14 months he'd resisted.
Mm-hmm. And I find it very perplexing that the president of the United States would resist such an investigation or such a commission to investigate.
Yeah, I mean,
do you have any explanation for that?
Well, I mean, Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, who from what I've read, she described herself as a person who was not very political. I don't know that she would have even voted in 2000. So you've got a range of people who are voting. Some were Democrats, some were more Republicans than Democrats on the Family Steering Committee, who told the press how they voted for the. But there were numbers I think didn't even vote. And she said to the 9/11 Commission on 31st of March 2003, when it first had its first public hearings, that she was, you know, really frustrated that she had to wait all of these, you know, over a year and a half for any investigation to start. And she said, we know that on the 28th of January 1986, there was a Challenger space shuttle with some loss of life of a few, you know, astronauts. And within 5 days, the Reagan administration put together a body to investigate that smaller event. So how could it be that with such a loss of life of nearly 3,000 people, that there would be such a foot dragging, and explanations from the vice president that they couldn't afford any money and that it would be distraction to the war on terror, and it would only encourage the terrorists to investigate.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to my rational mind. And as a part of this, to contextualize it, with the Patriot Act, Americans lost their privacy without due process. And so, you know, putting the pieces together, it was supposed to be for our best and highest good, for our safety and security. And of course, there are many who will argue that that's not the case. But the whole scenario, just there's something not right about it. What are some of the other questions that have come up for the families?
Yeah, well, let me set the table by telling you first what they were bumping into as the commission got rolling. And I love how you talk about seek and you will find, and the gospel, you know, and how there's also the Gospel of Thomas, the non-canonical take on that, where he says, seek and you will find. When you find, you'll become troubled. And then when you become troubled, you'll be astonished. And then you will come to a place of rest, or you will see with new perspective from a higher place. Mm-hmm. And I think that what the families ran into was Patty Casazza says, you know, I voted for President Bush and I thought he'd be our strongest advocate, but he ended up being our fiercest adversary. And so that's one of the things they seek, that. And then they run into all of this resistance. Lee Hamilton, who co-chaired the 9/11 Commission, didn't want to have any public hearings, didn't want to have any swearing of oath, didn't want to have any subpoenas. And so, and you also have the specter, the families are issuing press releases throughout the time. And they comment at one point about how witnesses are coming before the public hearings, but more significantly, there's 8 or 9 teams of 9/11 Commission staff that are meeting some thousands of witnesses behind closed doors because of security and privacy confidentiality of who these people are in the CIA and the FBI and so on. But what they find out is that you have somebody from the FBI or the CIA or the Department of Defense going before a 9/11 Commission staff to tell them what they know about something. And accompanying them is a government minder, somebody who's higher up in their department. perhaps standing with their hand on that person's, on the witness's shoulder, or sitting beside them. And when a question is asked of the witness, the government minder interrupts and answers the question for them. And the family said, these people don't feel free. They're self-censoring because they're worried about retribution if they say things to the 9/11 Commission staff. And so that's not how you run an investigation when you want to get to the bottom of what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so one of the questions I have is, you know, did they want to get to the bottom of it? That's my question.
Well, one of the things that they found out early on was that Philip Zelikow, who's like the face of the 9/11 Commission or the 10 commissioners, but behind it is Philip Zelikow, the executive director, and his office executive assistant, Heidi Hotteker, I think is her name, had a background of being staff for different embassies around the world, U.S. embassies. And so she was used to doing certain things professionally, including keeping a phone log of all the phone calls he received. And she found to her surprise that he was receiving numbers of phone calls from senior White House counsel Karl Rove. And it seemed that from what she was able to deduce, and a number of other 9/11 Commission staff were discovering, was that there was great consideration regarding how to steer the 9/11 Commission so that whatever the report was that came out in the summer of 2004, it would not embarrass or damage the sitting president's reelection chances. And that's not, in the view of the families, that's not the chief consideration of having this investigation, given this loss of life.
And of course, in consideration of our country and political transparency and stability, it's not in the best interest of Americans to have that withheld.
No. And another thing that they found out, in March of 2003, the executive director and another senior counsel, Ernst May, put together an outline of the 9/11 Commission report with all the chapter headings and all the subheadings. And when people looked at the report that came out, it was almost a mirror image of all of those things. Now, normally when you're doing a police investigation, and in the course of any trial, often there are new witnesses that people find out and they come forward. Sometimes a star witness, if you've seen Perry Mason or what, any of these other crime shows, suddenly a witness appears that no one knew about, who has some new information that changes the direction of the whole way the trial goes. But when you put together an outline that's prescriptive of what you think you're going to find, and when you have an executive director who's choosing not to, I mean, they're getting whistleblowers from different agencies that are calling the 9/11 Commission saying, I have some information in the Federal Aviation Administration, I think, but I need you to subpoena me so that I can safely share the information without retribution back in my agency. But when you have people phoning the 9/11 Commission and then the commissioners and their staff not getting back to these people, and the families who are in the family steering committee, like Patty Casaza, know this. They're having people coming up to them begging to get taken to the 9/11 Commission to speak to them. And so this, again, is simply wrong in terms of how to run an investigation. And so these are the kind of things they're finding out. One thing in terms of the questions, one of the questions is about this, you know, classified 28 pages regarding Saudi Arabia. And this has gone on through three administrations, Bush, Obama, and the Trump administration. And you have the specter of, in 2020, in April, Attorney General William Barr is speaking before a judge arguing why the 9/11 families cannot have information about these classified documents in their efforts to have a legal challenge or lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, because he says it will damage state secrets and harm American national security. I mean, for the families, you know, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or independent, or whether they vote at all, it just doesn't make sense then. How can our pursuing a lawsuit against a foreign nation of Saudi Arabia damage American national security?
Mm. Yeah. And it's almost like they don't want those responsible punished, perhaps, or they don't want the truth of who's responsible punished because, you know, or the illuminated because it could damage some sort of political machinations that occur behind the scenes. I mean, it's hard to know. And yet it must be incredibly unsatisfying. I mean, I think about the grieving process. Clearly, you still have moments of grieving the loss of your father some, what, 7 years later, 6 years later, whatever it is. Mm. You know, same thing with my parents. It's been 10 years. But it lessens over time. And I'm able to sort of see the perfection and how things unfolded and where things are at now. But if you still are like have these questions and feel like you're being shut down and that your curiosity isn't important and having the truth come out isn't important, it must be incredibly debilitating to the grieving process of these families.
Well, one of the things that I know family members, Lori Van Auken and Kristen Breitweiser and Mindy Kleinberg, whose husband Alan died in the North Tower, were saying that on the one hand, you have 9/11 commissioners, some of them before the press in March of 2003. Now that the family steering committee, the family members have brought to the commissioners, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions to ask different people, the president, vice president, Donald Rumsfeld, different agencies. And they're told, the commissioners say to the press, these questions will be, quote, a roadmap for how to do our inquiry. So that seems like they're really pleased and impressed with darn good questions. But at the end of the whole process, when the report is published in July of 2004, only 9% of the questions are answered with any seriousness. Others are brushed over in this way. Donald Rumsfeld was asked by Richard Benveniste, 9/11 commissioner, Mr. Rumsfeld, did you order fighter jets to be scrambled to defend the Pentagon? And he looked up on the wall and looked at the ceiling fixtures and around and eventually, you know, hummed and hawed, looked at a clock and repeated the question and said, did I order fighter jets to be scrambled to defend the Pentagon? And then Commissioner of the Chair, Tom Keene, banged the gavel and said, time's up, next question. Oh, well, my. You know, for the families who are sitting in the room and seeing that, it just doesn't honor their questions. And so, and then 70% of the questions weren't addressed at all. And so it seems like, you know, like, numbers of them just called it a cover-up. I mean, you know, of some sort, whatever is going on here.
Yeah, well, I've done another show. And in fact, folks, if you're curious about this, you can find it on my YouTube channel, where somebody who's in the military was one of the first responders at the Pentagon. And he was there for several weeks after, you know, after the plane crash explosion. He talks about how there were no plane parts. He talks about how, you know, there were entire conference rooms filled with people and no signs of trauma, but they were all dead in their chairs kind of thing. Some things that didn't make sense. So to have these bits and pieces, and I've seen some amazing videos and analyses of the Twin Towers. And, you know, I'm no expert. I don't have the answers. But just as a layperson kind of, you know, exploring some of these things, I think there are a whole lot of questions that would lead a person to think that maybe they are hiding something. And if Donald Rumsfeld is kind of refusing to answer or letting the time run out, or the whole situation is designed so that he doesn't have to answer, then you have to wonder, is there something being held, not only from the families, but from the American public?
Well, I mean, is there, you know, are there shocking lapses of security going on? Patty Casazza was on a phone call with her husband, John, in the North Tower, 104th floor, I think. And he said, I love you. Say I love you to our son, John Jr. And he also told her that he thought, and his colleagues thought, that there were bombs going off in the building. Now, without... without attributing what that the source of those, if there are bombs being planted, what that would be. I mean, there was a question the family said, ask the 9/11 commission, please, you know, discover what information there might be about any bombs going off in the building. During the fall and winter of 2001-2002, there were 503 first responders, mostly firefighters, some of them EMTs, from the Fire Department of New York, who all go individually and have an audio taped recording before their superiors, often with the FBI present, saying, here's what I experienced when I went in to rescue people in the Twin Towers. And of those 503 first responders, 118 of them volunteered that they witnessed variously, as they describe, explosions, grenades, secondary devices, bombs, their words. And they're describing things like, I saw somebody who was leaving the lobby of one of the towers, and suddenly they were kind of blown across the street to the boulevard. I mean, that's not what happens when, like, you know, maybe if you're on fire, you might run across the street, but you don't kind of get blown through the air, you know, 60 feet. So there are things that they're describing, you know, and when you have over 100 of them, it would make sense, but to have these first responders brought to the 9/11 commission to testify, maybe behind closed doors or whatever, but they didn't seem to be, for the most part, brought there, even though the FBI knew, and the 9/11 commission should have been told by the FBI if they weren't. And so, you know, I mean, President Bush said in 2006 in September that he thought Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's down in Guantanamo, had assigned some Al-Qaeda operatives to plant bombs in the building. But whatever is going on, it would seem that you'd want to look into that, because if that was the case, that the terrorists are planting bombs in the buildings, that's a massive breach of failure of security in a place that normally is very secure, especially since the 1993 truck bombing in the North Tower.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen a video from like street level of explosions going off in one of the towers, you know, and I mean, it wasn't like the building is collapsing and you see things coming. It was like you could see the light from explosions. And it's very conceivable that, you know, terrorists who's going to carry this out would put the explosive devices in there. And yet, how would they get in there with those explosive devices? And why are those questions not getting asked or properly answered?
Well, it confounds the family members. And it also, I mean, Sally Reaganhardt, who lost her probationary firefighter son, Christian, at the age of 28, and Monica Gabrielle, whose husband Richard died in the South Tower, had a family group called the Skyscraper Safety Campaign. And their chief concern was, what does this say? What are the implications? According to the official story, two steel frame buildings that were certified steel not to melt, you know, below 2750 degrees Fahrenheit. Here you have these buildings plus the World Trade Center 747 story skyscraper not hit by a plane, all collapsing in a matter of 10 seconds or less. What does this mean if you're a firefighter in New York City or anywhere around the world? Does that mean if you go into a building that's on fire, that it might suddenly just collapse into dust in a matter of seconds? I mean, if you were a firefighter and you thought that that might happen again, you might think twice about becoming a firefighter. Because I talked to Fire Commissioner Chris Gioia in the Franklin Square and Munson Fire Department in Queens. He says that, you know, we're brave, but we're not suicidal. If we actually thought that steel frame buildings would collapse like that, we wouldn't go in. But he says, Oreo Palmer is on the 78th, 79th floor of the South Tower. And he's 2 minutes before the South Tower collapses. He's there. He's telling the people in backup battalions just floors below him that it's safe for them to proceed. How can it be safe for him to proceed if the building is so hot that it's melting steel? And also, wow. Kevin Cosgrove is on the 100 and something floor. He's been on the phone in the South Tower since 9:44 a.m. for 15 minutes until the tower collapses to emergency people at 9/11, describing trying to get help. He's talking to the person on 911 on his landline. The receiver is cool enough for him to hold in his hand. The phone cord from his telephone to the wall is not disturbed, and nor is the plastic jack in the wall. So how can that all be intact, and yet the steel frame columns are melting?
This is so incredibly disturbing, because you'd think 20 years later there would be answers. And I know that there had been talk, there had been promises of declassifying some of the information. Did that occur?
Well, President Biden has very recently, after 1,800 family members wrote a letter to him saying, we don't want you showing up at any memorial anniversary unless you declassify some more information about the Saudi possible complicity. And he agreed to do that. But what he's agreed to do, from what I can tell, is he's agreed to launch a process where they'll decide which documents to release. It's not as if they're going to release all of them. So hopefully it will release the most pertinent ones, but they could also be opening the ones that are the least damaging. It's confusing for the families.
So are there some families who believe that somehow our government was complicit in this?
I've spoken to numbers of families who do suspect that the government was complicit in some way. An example would be, I mean, I've talked to Bob McElvain, whose family was featured on the Atlantic Monthly this September 2020. And for him, and for Joe Krakenfels, whose nephew Leonard Snyder died, there are questions about, for example, you have 19 hijackers, 15 of them are coming from Saudi Arabia. You have Michael Springman, who's with the State Department, the embassy in Saudi Arabia, U.S. embassy. And there are people in they're seeing people applying for visas. The visas have things like, what year were you born? Answer, 1878. Where are you going to stay in America? No answer. But what will you be doing? No answer. If either one of us tried to fill out a visa application, say if we wanted for some reason to go to Myanmar, I can tell you we wouldn't have our visa application accepted. And yet you have people in the CIA office adjacent to the state, to the U.S. embassy in Saudi Arabia, overriding the decisions by the embassy staff and fast-tracking these alleged hijackers into the USA. So it seems that the people are making generously very poor decisions, but maybe worse. Paul O'Neill, who was the Treasury Secretary with President Bush, writes in his memoir in 2004, The Price of Loyalty, that at the first cabinet meeting in January of 2001, the president said that he'd like to find a way to get America into a war in Iraq. And Donald Rumsfeld is going over the familiar talking points. Saddam's a bad guy, regime change, weapons of mass destruction, all those other things. And so, some family members wonder, and even Max Cleland, who was one of the 9/11 commissioners, wanted the 9/11 commission to investigate if there was a connection between the Iraq war and what happened on September 11th. But the other commissioners resisted doing that. And the person who replaced him, Bob Kerry, said in the 2000s on a radio show in New York that he thought that there were so many questions unaddressed by the 9/11 commission that there should be a permanent 9/11 commission to investigate what's left to look into.
So how do these families move forward with all this uncertainty, confusion, pushback, uncooperative exploration for truth?
It's been quite the pushback. I know that in the mid-2000s, Ann Coulter said that the Jersey widows who were Patty Casazza, Lori Van Auk, and Mindy Kleinberg, and Kristen Breitweiser, by asking their questions, any questions of what happened on September 11th, they were, quote, dancing on their husbands' graves. And that's just not true. You know, I mean, Patty Casazza says, you know, we went there to make the nation safe. And in Kristen Breitweiser's book, she, you know, the position, I think, of all the Family Steering Committee members in March of 2003 in through the spring of 2004 from their press releases, they were accepting, you know, the bare bones of the story by the government, which was 19 hijackers, 4 planes. So they were, you know, accepting that Osama bin Laden was responsible. It was only after the report came out with all these ignored questions that it raised more disturbing questions for them. But one of the things that the daughter of Kenneth Van Auken, Sarah Van Auken, went to college or university in Pennsylvania in the arts and drama. And in 2014, she performed a play in Philadelphia and off Broadway in New York called This Is Not About 9/11. And it's an interesting, I didn't get to see it, but I got to read a lot of articles about it. And what she does in this one woman play is she goes on stage with a suitcase full of memorabilia. And then the person who's, there's a person off stage who is the interviewer for the 9/11 Museum. And that person representing the 9/11 Museum in her play just wants to ask questions about the sad story about her dad dying and try and get the audience and her to just bring out the Kleenex boxes and tell a sentimental story that's very contained that we can all cope with about grief. But what she wants to do in her play is say, yes, but I have questions. And so she starts to say, you know, why was it that the only people who seemed to be able to fly when everybody else was grounded were relatives of Osama bin Laden in the days afterwards? So she starts asking these questions. She says, you know, a way for people to really honor my dad and others who died that day is to be curious about the questions. Instead of regarding any questioning as being unpatriotic, it's a service to those who died to ask the questions, because, you know, the dead, who speaks for them?
Yeah, if I had a family member or loved one who had passed in that way, I think I'd be angry. You know, they talk about the different stages of grief. I'm sure you're incredibly familiar with those, but it's that anger stage, because they're being shut down. And it could be that the truth would make people even angrier, and so therefore the truth is being withheld. It's hard to know. I mean, you know, are these things conspiracy theories? You know, perhaps. But yes, it's asking the questions seems like a very reasonable human thing to do. And it's unbelievable that they've been shut down so much.
There was a time early on when the families came to have a rally, some 300 of them, on the 11th of June, 2002. And Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut was there. And he and soon after that, Republican Senator John McCain were championing the families and the need for an investigation. There was a time, even in the media, from reading news stories and mainstream sources, where in the Los Angeles Times and other places, where the numbers of questions would be cited as examples of why it was important to have an investigation. But that seems to have changed. After the 9/11 Commission report came out, a lot of news sources cheerled the 9/11 Commission report. This is the definitive report. It didn't mention the many questions that were ignored. There were some, like Harper's Magazine, that said this is an embarrassment, and that the report was, in Harper's view, was in inviting Americans to engage in a relish for national fantasy, that this story didn't hang together from the view of the harp, partly because you have three important chapters, 5, 6, and 7 in the report that are all based on how the story of the 9/11 hijackers comes together. And all of that testimony to put that story together is gleaned from torture in Guantanamo. And so, you know, if you had a trial in an American court, the judge would not permit tortured testimony.
Right. Right. Yeah. So what's next for these families?
Well, for some of them, what's next is, I mean, they're all trying to make peace with what's happened at the same time. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, people like Kristen Breitweiser and Lori Van Auken have said to a reporter in the last years that they're still suffering from what they called PTBS, which they said was post-traumatic betrayal syndrome. So part of what they see happening, seek and you'll be troubled and you'll be astounded, and then you will come to a new place of seeing. So they see that sometimes politics trumps even the most important types of investigations. I know Mindy Kleinberg has said to refused to reply to three or more efforts by the Newark Star-Ledger to return phone calls and speak to the press back in 2012. I think numbers of these family members who were so pivotally involved with the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Independent Commission have chosen to say, you know, I've been involved in answering questions to the press now for 8, 12 years. I'm not going to do this for the rest of my life. I haven't signed up for this. But there are other family members. Drew DePalma is one of a number of family. His mother, Jean, died. And numbers of families have been interestingly, like, they were not involved in this effort to investigate early on. They just went into a private life for a long time. But numbers of them now, after 15, 17, 19 years, are starting to have their own questions bubble up for the first time and are now starting to ask the government to have a new investigation, which is interesting. I talked to somebody who said that their nephew was one of the police who was in the police helicopter taking photos of Ground Zero as the attacks were happening, as the towers were still up and after they crashed. And this person asked their nephew in the police force, the New York Police Department, if they thought about September 11th very much. And that person said, no, not really. And I think that for some people, they've just been sitting on not opening that door for two decades. And they may still yet, maybe in 2 years or five, they will suddenly start to open it. I think of this the way stories of uncles that I knew that fought in World War II, people who had fought on the Russian front in Finland or whatever it happened to be. And they hadn't spoken to their children or their spouse about that in many, many years. And maybe would have talked about it near the end of their life. It's how do we cope? That's one of the big questions.
Mm-hmm. And that compartmentalization, you know, is a very human thing to do. And sometimes it's a real necessity. And I certainly don't blame anybody who's doing that. But I also have a great deal of respect for those who are still pushing for truth. And I'm sure it's not just the families who are pushing for truth. I know that there's a whole movement to illuminate all sorts of things, including what happened on 9/11 within our country and within our world. So, as you've explored this, Ray, do you have any hope that sometime we're going to get clarity and have the truth illuminated?
I think that I have this hope, which is that, I mean, there's not been many books written about this particular aspect of what the families have done. There's other books like Rubble by Bob Kemper that talks about the resilience of families who picked themselves up and dusted themselves off and moved on and are now doing amazing things. But I've written a book about the Family Steering Committee itself. And I think that nobody knows the story about the 100th monkey. Nobody knows what it is that they're going to do that will make a difference, that will help open up a wider conversation. And I'm hopeful that there will be, in the years ahead, still pressure. I think about, there's all kinds of things that go generationally, issues even going back to the Civil War, and people talk about reparations for slaves. And I mean, somehow, you know, whatever we think about these bigger, longer historical stories, somehow even descendants of families affected by some event can still unexpectedly raise questions and somehow make a difference to a politician who might be in the right place, or a judge that might be in the right place at the right time. So I think that there's always reason for hope. And inside of us, we have this world of feelings, which is such a wonderful spiritual resource. If I'm feeling angry or happy or sad or puzzled, sometimes that feeling is a doorway into a spiritual wisdom that I don't know that I have unless I am curious about that feeling. And so for the families that are still curious about things, and for others too, it's useful to sit down and journal about it, or have a coffee with a friend and say, I've been thinking about something that's just not sitting right with me. And sometimes then you end up being someone like, maybe Rosa Parks wasn't comfortable with the way that she couldn't sit down on the bus. But one day she, had a conversation and then decided to sit down on that bus in Montgomery, mm-hmm. Alabama. So we never know what it will be, but something happens and then a door opens and then change happens.
And I think of it as, on some level, a loss of innocence, particularly for people here in the United States, but I think worldwide, that something so catastrophic, something could change the world in a moment or in a few moments. And sometimes that loss of innocence creates great woundedness, but other times, you're right, it opens a doorway for deeper exploration, for truth, and also in terms of our connection to that which is beyond this 3D realm.
Yeah, and I think that we have to trust every day when we wake up that we can be available to what we're confronted with, mm-hmm. Even if it's something horrific and atrocious is what happened on September 11th. For most of us, that won't ever happen. But even still, we run into different challenges, even family dynamics, and they can really throw us for a loop. So, yeah. But yet we believe, we're still siblings, we're still in the relationship with parents and children, and we carry on and find a way and find a door that opens to make things right.
Mm-hmm. I know that there are still some people who are, who were first responders, very close to Ground Zero, who are still suffering from the effects of, what was in the dust being breathed. Are people dying on a regular basis still?
I think so. It continues. And my sense is that it took nearly 20 years, but I think that there has been legislation finally passed in Congress in the last couple of years where more health benefits and help for those first responders, the heroes of 9/11, has been made available. That's another whole story that families just don't understand. How can you, is it the word lionize? I mean, look up to first responders and say what great people they are, and at the very same time withhold the financial aid that they need to take care of their health mm-hmm. when the EPA said it was safe to breathe.
Yeah, and I think about some of the controls and lack of justice relating to certain things going on in our world today, and it's almost like there are situations that aren't making logical sense, and they're actually penalizing the very people who have shown up in a big way. And I'm particularly thinking about the responders to the pandemic who are no longer being given a choice about what they put into their bodies. But that's, I diverge there. Okay. In just 2 minutes or less, do you have a message for us as we all process this loss of innocence, lessons perhaps from these families that we can use in our own personal lives?
I think that when we have suffered a loss, we can make a choice, which is ours to make, to keep that private and just share it with a few people. But we can also make choices to do the more surprising thing, to say something in the public arena to help heal things, help solve problems, fix things that needed to be fixed. And that when that happens, like the families found, all of them initially were individuals. Most of them didn't know each other, but then they found each other somehow. And so if you decide to take something on, you will find other emergent attractors. Other people will show up in your life who will be there to accompany you, to assist you, and who will walk with you and mentor you on that road that you've chosen. And so I think that whatever we're doing, if we make ourselves available, and we know that this is the calling for us, because if you bring someone which is not within you and try and bring it forth, you know, I mean, I could not be a skydiver because I'm too afraid of heights, but I could write this book. So we have to find out.
And again, we're running out of time. It's called Unanswered Questions. What's your website, Ray?
Oh, www.unanswered.ca, like the initials for California.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you'd like to empower yourself to step further into your vibration of change, please visit my website at christineupchurch.com, where you can learn more about my insights, upcoming events, and private sessions.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.